Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Tanner, and I'll be one of your hosts today. I'll be joined, as usual, by Taylor, plus another very special guest. But first, we have some new patrons to thank. So we want to give a shout out to Liz, and also thank you to Martha. And Martha, also thank you for the nice message that you sent. Those make us feel really good when we get to read those on Patreon. So we hope both of you enjoy all of the bonus stuff that's up there for you to check out. So with that, I guess I will bring in Taylor and our special guest, Tom.
Yes, hello. You have the three T's today.
That's right.
This is the way to do it. This is the ideal form of the podcast.
So I'm Tom Payne. Thanks for inviting me on. Of, I guess 10,000 losses fame, maybe. And I've been on Where There's Your Problem twice. And we talked both times was about boats.
If you listen to Well, There's Your Problem, you might recognize Tom's voice from, you did the episode about the El Faro.
Yes.
And what
the,
else?
What was the other one? The Belgian ferry, the Ro-Ro ferry that didn't close the door.
The Herald of
Hereford and
Free Enterprise.
The most cursed named boat ever.
Oh, God.
which if you haven't listened to those episodes, I do go into that. Obviously, it's not as, straightforward in the... I listen to your podcast. I listen to it, like, when I'm in, be vague here, search and rescue volunteering mode. Like, I'm driving 2 hours to a meeting or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you guys, get me like, oh, we it's more considerate, thing like that. Whereas... Well, there's your problem. It's just very vulgar. I'm not even going to say the jokes here. But if you like that kind of jokes, I mean, I talk about Belgian bodybuilders on that one. I talk about what might be in a locker. And then the El Faro one, I think it's just me getting mad at the captain for being so stupid. Because you guys have covered the El Faro, right?
That was our very first episode.
That was your first one. Yeah, yeah. And it's the most... Oh, man. I mean, it's so... The guy is... I know so many guys are like that, like these old head. So I've run into lots of guys who think because they have their like unlimited master's license, they're somehow king. There you go. There's your first curse. King, they think they're amazing. And it's like, no, you still have tons to learn. And one of the things you should learn is to never trust anything that's not the weather service.
Well, the funny thing with the El Faro story is because, like, that was our first episode. Like, you know, Taylor had the idea to make this shipwreck podcast. And, like, I didn't know anything about ships or shipwrecks or whatever. But, like, I read through that whole report. And, like, the whole time we talked about it, I didn't really have a good standard to judge by. I was like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be too harsh because, like, I don't really know what's going on. Like, is this, like, a normal way for a captain to behave? Mm-hmm. If we made that episode now, I think it would be very much the same sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, especially reading the book, Into the Raging Sea.
Yes, excellent book.
That gets a little bit more into the people involved. And I think that also kind of highlighted the fact that, okay, this was, nothing about this was acceptable.
Right, yeah. And that, you know, what I like about that book is that it does straight up call out the systemic material causes of that, mm-hmm. you know, the economic system and stuff like that versus... You know, sometimes the NTSB, I mean, the NTSB will lay blame, but they tend not to go beyond like the structure of the company or something like that. Whereas mm-hmm. that book is very, very well done and had made a lot of people mad, which is a good thing.
And that's by Rachel Slade. We'll make a note about that in the show notes in case anyone wants to check that out. So let's see, for our welcome segment, we usually do a little media check-in, just to talk about whatever you've been up to, reading, watching, playing, creating. Mm-hmm. So, Tom, what have you been up to?
Well, I've been slowly working my way through this book called A Horse, the Wheel, and Language by David W. Anthony. It's it's about Proto-Indo-Europeans and mm-hmm. where the origins are, and it's very academic. It's definitely accessible. But it's something that I've been very slowly reading it because it's dense and I kind of want to reference everything they mentioned with like maps. Mm-hmm. That's my problem with nonfiction is I always want to have map. I mean, I literally mm-hmm. while we're talking, I got the chart up for the Delaware River just so I have the map. But yeah, that's a really good book if you're interested in language or it's written by a archaeologist who mm-hmm. has basically written the best hypothesis of where like the Indo-European languages homeland was, which is what's now Ukraine. And he goes through all the evidence, the archaeological, genetic. I'm only like halfway through it. Archaeological, genetic, linguistic. It's super cool. So if you're into that stuff, like I majored in history. I'm an English teacher. I'm a language nerd. So for me, that's like, it's crack. But that's a really good book. I'm trying to reread The Silmarillion.
Oh, yeah.
So I got that too. And then
also a lot of history and language involved there.
A lot of books referencing with maps too. You got to do that. I think, you know, game-wise, I'm a banner lord. I've been slaying some Vlandians. So there you go. If you've ever played Banner Lord, shouts out to Banner Lord.
I have it.
Oh, yeah. You fight as like a, you're like a medieval guy in this like empire that's collapsing, and you can pick sides. It's like early medieval themed. So you get like, you know, Byzantines and like Normans and Celts. It's cool.
Sweet.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking it up now.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. The book you talked about, Tom, that sounds like tailor-made for my interests.
You
mentioned the writing style, because like I majored in linguistics at university, and like I'm an English teacher, so yeah, also a language nerd. And what I find also with books about language, they're usually best when they're not written by linguistics people, because linguistics people get very far into themselves, and then you wind up with like a Steven Pinker, and you never want a Steven Pinker.
No, you do not. So no, and he kind of in the book he chides like archaeologists who don't like linguists, and there's some similar reasons there. That's right, because you're like a teacher of, is it, you're an English teacher or TOEFL, like English as a foreign language?
Yeah, I teach. I'm a
ESL.
Yeah, an intensive English program for university preparation. So work with international students. I was never that big into like the linguistic, like the theory aspect. I think I was far more interested in languages than I was in like capital L language.
Yeah.
Like I still enjoy some of that stuff. I'll get like a wild fancy in my head. Like, oh, I should go get like a doctorate in linguistics. And then I'm like, no, I don't want to.
I don't want to be doing, you know, syntactic trees for the rest of my life.
Yeah. It's like, it's fun occasionally, but I don't want to do this. This is, you end up in a semantics, classroom spending 4 hours talking about what a chair actually is.
And
it's not my, it ends up not being my thing. I love the phonology, the morphology aspects of it.
I would have been, if I was born like in a different time, maybe like 20 years old, I would have been a philologist. Like that's what's interesting to me.
That's awesome. I'm definitely going to be checking out that book for sure. Taylor, what about you? I know you've been doing some reading also.
Yeah, I've been trying to like make myself read more. I realized I hadn't read like a fiction book in like 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. So I figured it was time. I finished The Master and Margarita, which I liked. That was a good recommendation on your part.
Yes.
And then I decided that I wasn't done with Russian literature, so I started Crime and Punishment.
Wow.
Hell yeah.
Dedicated.
So I don't know.
I have like Anna Karenina like on my desk, just sitting there. I'm like, I will get you to do someday, but
I've read the first chapter of Crime and Punishment. I like it. I like that kind of psychological stuff. So it should be a fun read, I think.
Crime and Punishment is one of those books that has like, it has this reputation as being like this massive tome, like War and Peace or Anna Karenina. And it absolutely is not. It's a lot shorter than those. And it's very like fast paced, even though very little actual action takes place. It's like very psychological. So yeah, I think you're going to really enjoy Crime and Punishment.
Yeah, I think it was like 850 pages. So it didn't feel that bad. I think Master and Margarita was like 570. So it didn't feel like it was that much more really. But that's it really. That and Work. People need their stuff moved, so I move it.
Also, I'll say if you enjoyed Master and Margarita, there's a book called Danilov the Violist. Mm-hmm. I think it's by Dmitry Orlov, I want to say his name is. Very similar thematically, and a lot of the same type of like Russian zaniness.
Yeah, I loved Behemoth was by far my favorite character. Loved the cat.
He's a great character. Let's see, I guess I've been up to watch some of the World Baseball Classic.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of good games there. Eat Great Britain.
Oh no, what are those jerseys? Oh my god, what is that?
These that they made in Microsoft Word. You know, I sat down to watch a baseball game last night, but I didn't realize I was going to watch the Battle of Saratoga instead.
It's like you said, that was weird, like cheering on a Kyle Schwarber home run. I felt
hell
wrong.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah, it was. After, you know, you as a Reds fan and me as a Brewers fan, like Kyle Schwarber has hit bunches of home runs against our teams.
I think actually, though, I have decided I'm a Guardians fan for the year just because the Reds don't deserve it.
They don't deserve it.
It's sad already giving up on baseball and it's still spring training.
You could always become a Phillies fan. Well, you can have your second team. Welcome to Philadelphia. Schwarbaum's, we celebrate. We have billboards. We have Kyle Schwarber on it because he was like doing, he was like a Wawa spokes guy last year. Like that. So love a Schwarbaum. I mean, God, man, that guy can hit a ball. I'll tell you that. Like bat control, he doesn't even fully follow through. Like it's not like me when I was a kid. It's completely swung around my body and like hitting the, you know, the catcher with it on the back end.
No one makes them as definitively gone as Schwarber does. But yeah, that was fun. Nice showing for the U.S. I was a little bit worried when they were down 1-0 early, but you know what? It happens. Got to let them win a few.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the Bunker Hill.
Hungry dogs got to eat. I mean, got a kid. The one kid was like hitting 200 in A for the A ball for the Toronto Blue Jays. He slaps a single in the right field. It's like, yeah, of course you're gonna. This is your chance to maybe you'll get a little extra look. You know,
it's like the beginning to the documentary Hamilton. The British have to win a little bit at first.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I also started reading another Glenn Cook novel. I've mentioned him before on the podcast. This is With Mercy Toward None. It's a prequel to his Dread Empire series. Glenn Cook's most famous for his Black Company novels.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and those are really, I love those. And then this is part of his series that he had written before The Black Company that have kind of been republished since he got a bit more famous. Yeah, I enjoy those. He's a good writer. He writes dialogue really well, kind of hyper realistically to the point where you have to reread things a couple times because like he doesn't exactly spell out who's talking to who and what the context is. But yeah, I love reading his books. They make me very happy, and I haven't really read any fiction recently. I've been stuck in a lot of nonfiction, obviously Shipwreck stuff for the podcast. Then I was reading that book about Peshtigo. So nice to go into a fantasy world a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge fantasy fan. So, I mean, it's part of my conlang bit, and eventually maybe that'll go into a story that's been floating around my head for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. I've written maybe 5 pages on, but I'm like, I don't have names for these people. I don't know where the land is. I need to have this first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we both have those stories as well. Like I've got like 10 pages here and there's something.
Yeah.
One day I'll do it.
Yeah. I have like a decent chunk of something written, but it's like none of it doesn't go together. Like what am I doing with all this stuff? It'll all come together at some point for all of us, I'm sure. Well, I guess we are obligated by the nature of the podcast to jump into the story here.
Yeah, sorry for distracting you with 16 minutes of nonsense.
This is cool.
That's my want.
No, this is cool. So this episode has us revisiting an old enemy of ours, the Duck Boat. And back to a place we've been before on an episode. We're going to be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Last time we were here, I think was when Taylor told us about the Dead Fleet.
Yeah, on location from Philly at that time. Yeah. So that was.
And this time we have someone more or less on location also. And that was what, episode 73? So that was a while ago. Getting into the background here, the Duck Boat of concern here is it's called Duck 34, operated by our friends at Ride the Ducks International, LLC. So yeah, this is the same company that operated the duck boats we talked about at Table Rock Lake in Branson, Missouri. That was way back in episode 31. You see pictures of these, you'll notice that they look almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Actually, the figure number one in the NTSB report is just a picture of one of the Branson duck boats because they're similar enough that
they might made them be there, the I believe, right? They were made by they're new make duck boats.
Yeah, so they, and I don't exactly know the ins and outs of that. I know that they were constructed like, I think in Branson? Then I think at the time the company was headquartered in Georgia somewhere. So yeah, this is the more or less the same people we've talked about before. Although this incident does happen a few years earlier.
Yeah. So this is like this foreshadowing here is like, this is foreshadowing for the other episode. Mm-hmm. Go listen to that one after this one, I guess, if you haven't listened to it yet. But
yeah,
no, these guys are like, they're like Teflon, man. Nothing sticks.
It is
just
amazing.
Like, it's like a duck, I guess. But
we go more into the history of duck boats in that episode, starting out in a military role as a kind of an alternative to the classic Higgins boat style landing craft in World War II. So that amphibious quality helped with things like crossing rivers, small bodies of water. They're intended to be in the water for pretty short amounts of time and not really designed for long-term durability. If we think back to our quote from one of the designers back in the 40s when they were being developed.
She's better in water than any truck, and she'll beat any boat on a highway. That's until Elon makes his truck that can swim, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't that one of the things he was working on?
I've seen some of the Cuban guys fleeing Cuba, like, was it like an old Ford pickup that they hooked a prop up to the axle, or to the powertrain. So I don't know, man. I don't know. That might have a better safety record than the duck boats.
It probably does.
Yeah. So yeah, when these things are used commercially, they're usually employed in sightseeing tours, partially conducted on land and partially on water. So you'll see they'll have an hour long tour, and maybe 15 to 20 minutes of that is on the water.
Yeah, and I was telling you guys before, I did go on one of these. So I think it was like 20. They started in like 2003, so it was like 2003, 2004. I think I was on one. I don't remember the land portion, but I do remember the water portion. I remember being, wow, the water is really close to the, I didn't know what a gunwale was then, but yeah, it's really close to this. I could stick my hand in it. You know.
Yeah, the freeboard on these is minimal. Yeah, and actually I think the first civilian duck boat casualty did happen in Milwaukee, if I remember from our,
oh, really?
Our first episode. So yeah, that's one at some point. If we wanted to go back to duck boats, we can visit a place that we know, Milwaukee. Well, this brings us kind of up to, we'll jump right to the day of here. So the date of our story today is July 7th, 2010, and the location is the Delaware River in the city of Philadelphia.
Go Birds!
So at 2:15 p.m. local time, Duck 34 entered the water just south of the Benjamin Franklin Bridge, and it turned south for the standard river portion of the sightseeing excursion.
So where the Ben Franklin Bridge is north of Penn's Landing. And nowadays there's just like, it's the Arch Street Pier, but there's a ramp right there. It's been there that you can go. It's right under the bridge. You can see the Patco trains running ahead. And it's pretty standard. You would do like your tourist center city, like of all the, you know, old sites, you go by like Alfred's Alley, you know, you go Independence Hall, that kind of stuff. And as you probably, they will go up Second Street. I think Second Street. No, down Second Street's the other way. So I think they go up Front Street. Can't remember. Anyway, it would cut over and go to Arch Street and pop in the water there before heading south.
We had talked about this a little bit before recording. Where is this more or less in relation to the Dead Fleet that we talked about before?
Yeah, so the Dead Fleet is right across. It's right. The Dead Fleet right now is behind like a Home Depot, and there's like a parking lot there, and then two piers south is the SS United States. Across from that's IKEA. There's a really good cheesesteak place called John Rose Pork, which if you are coming to Philadelphia, that's like one of the places I recommend. And you can either get the cheesesteak or the roast pork sandwich. The roast pork sandwich is something people don't know about from Philly, but is, I think, culinarily a better option if you're into food. But get it with sharp provolone and broccoli rabe. But the cheesesteak's good too. But they usually sell out pretty early. But yeah, so you can eat that next to an old like chemical plant, and you got the SS United States like to your east, and then you can't see the Dead Fleet because of the Home Depot and the parking lot. There's like other stuff there. It used to be like a little Navy, but there's like a running trail that goes behind it. And so you had the running trail and then the waterfront, because no one uses those piers anymore, like right there. Are pretty gross. So yeah, you can still see the Dead Fleet's there. It's still there. Low tide, you can see them. You know, some say on certain nights you can hear the ghostly, you know.
The ghosts of the dead child falling through the rotting planks.
Yeah.
God, I hated that story. That's
Delaware River mud too.
That one was. I was reading that. I was like, oh no, I have to read this on the podcast now.
One time, we were on a recovery once, not there, but further down the river, but by the airport behind Tinicum Island, which, you know, if you have a map in front of you, you're going down past the airport, past the Navy Yard, past the mouth of the Schuylkill, and there's an island there called Little Tinicum Island. And a guy had jumped in. There's a couple of yacht clubs back there. People are always boozing up. And a guy jumped in for a swim at like 2 a.m. And he was, the next day he was like, you know, hey, he never came home. So we were doing a search patterns for him up, all up and down. And they found him. He was stuck in the mud. The fire department found him doing dock walks. And we missed him on a dock walk. I guess a low tide revealed him. But yeah, like feet first stuck in the mud. Delaware River mud is like, I mean, that's what they use for baseballs. That's the rubbing mud. But yeah, it's not a way to go, man. That sucks.
No.
Yeah.
So with our duck boat here today, Duck 34 was carrying 35 passengers as she entered the water. 13 of these were students from Hungary, along with two Hungarian teachers. So something that'll come up later when we get to the analysis portion. It's possibly important to keep in mind that of the 35 total passengers, 15 of them do not have English as their first language.
Yeah. Not a lot of Hungarians in Philadelphia, so it's not like you're really expecting to have your Hungarian tour guide conductor pop one. You know, right. Like Spanish or, you know, Ukrainian or something, like where we got a lot of people speaking that.
Seven of those aboard were Americans acting as hosts for the Hungarian group, and the remaining passengers were just various walk-ups, so some individuals, pairs, and small groups. Duck 34 had a crew of two. The master is 58 years old. He'd worked with Ride the Ducks since spring of 09. Master had a Coast Guard master's license for steam and motor vessels not exceeding 50 gross tons. He also had his CDL, which is something actually required for operating the duck boat on the land portion of the tour.
Yes.
I didn't know that. I didn't know you had to have a CDL for that. Yeah. Does it have air brakes? Is that why you have to have the CDL? You know?
I have no idea.
Good question. We're touching on something I know about now.
I know that you had to have a passenger endorsement too. So like these duck boats like were a menace. In the city, they would have their little duck quacky things. They're driving by, and listen, you know Philadelphians, like So we can be very kind and friendly, but when you're just randomly quacking at us, like, boss, what are you doing? Why are you quacking at me? You just have some guy in jorts, and you have a guy in jorts with a white a shirt, Adidas slides, and Nike socks. And he's I don't know, he's like finding you cigarettes on the ground. The someone starts duck quacking nearby, and it's like, nah, man, he's gonna start screaming, cursing at you. So I ask where you're from, what parish is your mom, it's ridiculous. But yeah, no, but the thing is they have like, it's funny because back then we were like, could you imagine a vehicle on the road where when you stop, you can't see passengers in front of you? And then 7 years later, we have the
every pickup truck made
that are designed to run through protesters. Mm-hmm. So, we kind of a little foreshadowing there, but it killed a woman once too. Like that was the death knell for the duck boats. This wasn't what we're going to talk about, but the killing the woman at a crosswalk, because you literally couldn't see, you would be stopped at the white line in the crosswalk. You could not see anyone in the crosswalk. So they were a menace.
Yeah. We saw with the Branson duck boats where I think it was like the following season, guys like, oh, we could bring these back. And like 17 people died like right here on this lake. And you want to bring these things back because you want to make some money off of it.
Yeah.
Let's see. So we talked about the master. The second crew member on board is a deckhand, aged 18. He'd been with Ride the Duck since 09. He didn't have any certification, Coast Guard, Merchant Marine license, but he wasn't required to in his position. And he did have some self-reported experience on small boats.
And I believe his dad actually worked for the other company that we'll get into. Yeah. But so he wasn't like someone who had no maritime experience whatsoever.
Yeah, that was a weird detail here. So the duck boat's route took it south for about 10 minutes past Penn's Landing, at which point it would turn around, reverse course back north to the boat landing. Total time in the water was intended to be about 20 minutes.
I think that's what's always so interesting in these is like how dangerous they actually are, because they don't spend that much time in the water. And there's just so many bad things that happen while they're there.
And you know, so like Penn's Landing is like those who don't know, like this is like, it's weird. They're doing a better job connecting it to the rest of the center city. And that's a shibboleth for you. If you're from Philly, you call it Center City. If you're not from Philly, you call it downtown. So Penn's Landing is like right there. It's weird. The Delaware River channel abuts Penn's Landing. I want to say maybe 50 feet, if that, off of Penn's Landing. So, but it's like, you know, it's a tourist spot. So there's all, they have concerts there. They do fireworks in the summer. Now they have like, they put up like a pop-up beer garden and stuff like that. So it's a place that, you know, it's not much. You see nice pictures of Philly. It's usually taken from there, like from the water. That you got a nice view. So that's all it is. There's not a ton there. It's disconnected from the city.
Is it akin to like a Navy Pier kind of in Chicago? Is it that sort of area?
But not as connected to the rest of the city. You have to like cross over a buried highway. I-95.
I used to say, is 95 like kind of cutting it off from everything else?
Yeah. So I-95. Thanks, Kevin Bacon's dad. Appreciate you wanting that run through Center City instead of through Camden, was where they wanted to run it. And they had built 295 anyway that goes through Camden. So what was I going to say there? They actually, just fun aside, sorry, this is like me. You asked me on here. It's going to be fun asides.
No, it's good. Yeah, all the stuff, all the whatever the asides. We'll leave it in for Patreon for sure.
We got the where the Marine Corps was found, a Tun Tavern. That location is somewhere in the southbound lane of 95, not too far from where this happened. So it's like all this history and stuff has been cut off. I would say it's like it would be like Inner Harbor, Baltimore, if again it was still connected to the city. You didn't have to cross, you know, all these lanes of traffic. It's buried. Parts of it are buried, but you know, in the summer, stuff like that could be like a bit of a, you gotta go up and down. It's annoying.
We have our boat in the water, heading south, turning back north. Just after turning back for that northward leg, the master noticed an odor along with what he took to be smoke coming from the boat's engine compartment. And the wording there in the report is significant.
Yes.
So when noticing this, he initiated emergency procedures. He shut down the engine. He started the emergency fuel shutoff, and he closed the port and starboard fire dampers. Mm-hmm. He didn't deploy the CO2 fire suppression system, judging that his actions had already dealt with, you know, any sort of fire issue in the engine. And he also didn't want to do that unless absolutely necessary, because obviously that gets in the passenger compartment, right? And that kind of ruins everyone's day. It's about to be ruined anyway. The master had been in the jump seat next to the helm, conducting the tour narration while the deckhand navigated the boat. And then as soon as the emergency stuff happened, the master sort of took over and took the helm. Next part is pretty uniquely worded in the report, so I'd like to quote from that directly.
The master told investigators that he made a call on VHF channel 13 to alert other vessels in the vicinity of the situation on board Duck 34. No such call at the time was captured on any of the available recordings of radio transmissions, nor did anyone interviewed for the accident investigation recall hearing such a call.
So I want to point out that the Coast Guard Sector Delaware Bay and Boat Station Philadelphia are like a mile from here, if that. And they have a big radio tower, and they monitor and they're monitoring every channel basically and recording it. Because this was like, right at like Rescue 21, the whole initiative where they had these new radio towers that could record these things. So they have that ability, and it's not recorded. And just for people maybe who don't know, channel 13 is the bridge calling channel. So that's not the general calling channel. That's channel 16, where everyone is monitoring basically, you know, everyone commercially. Channel 13, I think it's a vessel greater than 20 meters has to monitor it, but it's, hey, boat coming around the bend. I'm coming around the bend. Let me know. Or you have like, for some reason, Russian people cursing in Russian. That's happened before. They try to find out what boat that's coming from. So he called on channel 13, but that's the ship to ship navigation. Hey, we're meeting by the bend. All right, I'm going starboard. You're going port. You know, like it's not the general calling channel.
So, see, after that, the master then called Ride the Duck manager on duty to inform him of their emergency situation. That manager started making arrangements for another duck boat to come and give them a tow. At this point, there was a third duck boat, Duck 44. They had arrived on scene. They'd been traveling the same route, so they're just behind Duck 34. The master Duck 44, the new arriving boat, he was told by the deckhand that they had just overheated, the problem had been radioed in, and just to continue on with their tour.
Imagine though getting like rescued by a duck boat when you're on a duck boat. Like, no thanks, send something else.
Send something safer. Well, yeah. And that duck boat, the NTSB notes that duck boat was full and was not capable of towing. So Duck 44 did not have the like the bridle or whatever they used, you know, to tow. So
there's not much they really could have done anyway.
No.
So, yeah. Ride the Ducks, they dispatched another boat to tow Duck 34 back to the boat ramp. And at this point, it's around 2:29. This is when the deckhand dropped the boat's anchor on the orders of the master. So this leaves Duck 34 anchored about 320 feet from Penn's Landing and almost exactly in the middle of the navigation channel.
Yep. You are in the middle of the channel, anchored in the middle of the channel.
This is akin to like breaking down in the middle lane of like an interstate, essentially.
And then popping your hood and putting it on your four ways, but in the middle lane. Not, yeah, you're not pulling over to the shoulder or anything like that. And I want to point out too is that the duck boat did not, the duck boat dispatch did not contact the Coast Guard, which they were supposed to do. That was part of their procedures and they failed to do that.
Yeah, that's definitely something that comes up in kind of the analysis portion later where, you know, one of the more egregious things here is that, you know, the Coast Guard isn't contacted directly.
Right. And, you know, when you are in the middle of the channel and you are anchored, you're now a hazard to navigation, right? And and the hazard navigation of the channel is required to make that known. And that's, I mean, we'll talk more about the, obviously we're going to follow up more with what they do say on the radio, allegedly say on the radio. No one picked that up. Like you said, despite the radio, you could see the radio tower from there. Mm-hmm. If you were a good shot, you could hit it with a gun from there. You know what I mean? Like, it's not far away. It's right there.
Let's see. So as Duck 34 had been entering the water near the Ben Franklin Bridge, another vessel was headed northward on the river. And this was the KC Transportation Tugboat Caribbean Sea, configured in a starboard hip tow with the 250-foot tank barge, the Resource. So Caribbean Sea had a crew of five total with three on duty. That was the mate who was navigating the vessel, a deckhand, and an engineer. The master and deckhand number two were in their quarters. So just after anchoring, the master and deckhand of Duck 34, they spotted the tug and barge heading towards them at an estimated distance of 1 nautical mile, which I might be overthinking this, but location data revealed this to be only about a third of that. In actuality.
You're not overthinking that. This is an area where you can pilot by Seaman's Eye, right? You can, and you have, it's very, once you get out in the water and you start getting your bearings about how far things are, and I don't know about these duck boat guys, but, you know, one of the things I was trained to do is you just start, you know, you could put up the radar and put up the rings and that can help you figure it out. Or you look at a chart and you say, this is how long this looks on the water. Because sometimes perspective can shift things. But you are in a very, very densely, it's the waterfront of Philadelphia. It's a dense area. There are tons of landmarks. Getting a fix on your position is not hard. And visually, I mean, there's a big difference between 2,000 yards and 600 something yards. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. It was the master and the deckhand estimated. The master should have known better. And that one, you should have your Seaman's Eye there. It's
right away. We're kind of starting in a bad spot because they're drastically overestimating how far away this is. So the master said he made another call on channel 13. This one also not captured by any recordings. The master thought the tug appeared to be changing course, and he said about doing some maintenance to seal two access plates on the engine control panel to basically just to keep that smoke out of the passenger area. So he's pretty focused on that. When he completes that work, he looks back to the tug and sees that it had not, in fact, changed course and that it appeared a collision would be possible.
Right. And why would a tugboat? I mean, we'll get to the analysis, but, you know, this is a tugboat in the channel, right? It's a vessel restricted its ability to maneuver. And I don't know how the draft wasn't that bad. It could have left the channel draft wise, but it's got right away. It's like, you know, it's like you're parking your car on the train tracks.
Right.
You know, this is where the tug goes and you anchored in the channel.
Yeah. So we have this developing issue. He tries the boat's horn, which proved to be inoperable because with the configuration at the time, the horn wouldn't work if the engine was shut off. The master made three additional calls on channel 13, trying to alert the tug that his boat was broken down and sitting at anchor. These were captured. Unlike the previous two attempts, but there's no radio response or movement to indicate that the call was heard by Caribbean Sea.
Is there any chance that like when he's doing those first two calls, he's not actually transmitting basically when he thinks he's making the call and he isn't, if if it's not capturing it, and now it is.
It's possible.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of like an airline disaster where like you're distracted by something and, you know, you're not giving it your full attention.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a hard mistake to make, though. I mean, it's like, but yeah, I could see, you know, maybe you're like the other interpretations that he'd lied about it. But yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was like trying to read in this is like, what is the implication here? Is mm-hmm. it that he just straight up didn't make a call? Like he thought he did, but he just never did. You know, was he just, were they saying he straight up lied about this? But yeah, I was very curious about that. So just before 2:37, the duck boat's master made a final attempt on channel 16 saying, "Hey, ferry, ferry, whoa, whoa." Hmm. So at this point, collision is imminent, and the master orders passengers to don life jackets.
Hmm.
Here, I'll take a pause here for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting with this, just seeing how fast it is, but how slow it is at the same time with all of this going on.
Yeah, when you're closing distance too, like you don't realize it, like how big these boats are. And I mean, the resource isn't, I mean, it's 250 feet, it's big, but it's not like, it's not a tanker, you know?
Right, yeah.
All right, jumping back in here. So at 14:37... in 23 seconds, the resource contacted the stern of Duck 34. So this is only about 30 seconds after the master's life jacket announcement. After about 10 seconds of contact, the duck boat rolled to starboard and was pushed underwater. That video is available for those who want to see it. It's not exactly a fun watch, but even if you just use it to look at like a still shot, just to see the size disparity here between the barge and the duck boat.
This isn't like a glancing blow. Like this is a rolling it over. Like it goes over it.
So on the duck boat, not all passengers had time to even get a life jacket. And the ones who did manage to grab one were not able to get them on fully and properly before the collision. So that's noted in the report that there's not a single passenger who had time to fully secure their life jacket. Some of those on board reported only being able to grab one floating in the water after they had resurfaced.
Reading their accounts of like, I followed the light out of the, like, I couldn't see anything. And point this out, the Delaware River is a very turbid river. I mentioned the mud earlier. It's just, you know, it's not, it was always been turbid. It was turbid before the Industrial Revolution. Like the accounts of that, it's just a muddy river. Mm-hmm. And I just the thought of like being under in the Delaware, like mm-hmm. gives me a little bit of anxiety, like having been there so often, like, I mean, hundreds of hours on this river and, you know, seeing things like floating by and you can see it maybe a foot or two under, like that's like, as far as when it's really, especially if they're like rains or something like that, the visibility is like nothing underwater. So yeah, how they got out is nigh a miracle.
So yeah. Most of the passengers described that like they don't recall how they got out. They just kind of found themselves, you know, in the water or on the surface. One of the fortunate things here is that because it was so warm, mm-hmm. the side curtains were rolled up. So those windows were open and, you know, able to egress, which is one of the things we talked about in the Branson and the previous one. I forget where it was. I think it was in Arkansas somewhere, where that canopy and those side curtains contributed to the fact that people were not able to get out of the duck boat when it went underwater.
And I don't think we mentioned that it's 101 degrees when this happened.
Yes, that.
Yeah, it is a Philadelphia summer. When we get high, it gets hot, it gets humid. Philadelphia is a very humid city. So, I mean, that might come into play later too when we do the analysis part.
So on the Caribbean Sea, the master was notified of the collision and he took control. He swung the tug and barge around to starboard with the other crew acting as lookouts. In this case, you know, the actual ability to assist with rescue is pretty minimal, given the nature of the vessel. The master attempted to call the Coast Guard on channel 16. Another vessel was already communicating on that channel about the incident.
Yeah, the Riverlink ferry is kind of looks like an old kind of steam. It looks like something you'd see on the Mississippi. You know, it definitely would be tough for some. They weren't prepared for it. I'm sure they train on it. Because they've called stuff. I've heard them call stuff in before, too. Like, they do keep an eye on things. But they would be tough to get on board.
This first vessel who's kind of on scene responding to this is this this ferry, the Freedom. Mm-hmm. And so this ferry just goes, like, basically straight across the river.
Yep.
Is that Okay.
Well, regular schedule, Camden, the Philly, you know.
So yeah, the master of freedom, he had heard those quick succession of emergency calls from Duck 34 when she had said she was stranded and at anchor. So quoting here from the NTSB reports.
He was approximately 3/4 to 1 mile away, and I saw the barge heading towards the APV. He said he attempted to hail the tug on Channel 13, but got no response. His view of the APV then became obscured by the bridge. Shortly thereafter, his senior deckhand reported seeing life jackets in the water. The ferry's master said he made best possible speed towards the accident site, and as they approached, he saw people in the water. He surveyed the area and noticed that one person was further from shore than the others, toward the center of the river. He decided to assist that person first. The person was the deckhand. He said that they rescued the deckhand, after which he saw the marine police and Coast Guard boats had arrived and were assisting the rest of the passengers.
And just as a note there, I don't know if we've talked about this term. APV used in the report and in that quote is just amphibious passenger vehicle. That's how they refer to the duck boat frequently in the report. So units of Philadelphia PD were dispatched after a 911 call at 2:40. Two boats were launched by Philadelphia Marine Police. Three boats from Coast Guard Sector Delaware Bay were launched. Mm-hmm. So both the Marine Police and the Coast Guard, they shared the same dock facility, just under a nautical mile from the accident site. So they were on scene within 3 minutes of being notified.
Yeah, you could if you were standing on the where sector is. The boat station's like on the north side, and the Philly police keep stuff. The Philly Fire Department keeps some stuff there too. The Philadelphia fireboats are usually docked, but if you were on the there's a buoy tender there, the William Tate. If you were on like the William Tate dock and walking out where they keep the buoys, you would have been able to like look straight up the river and see this happening. Like it's not far.
Yeah, and that definitely comes into play, the fact that this is in such a monitored and trafficked area in terms of getting to people here. So also assisting in the rescue just on their own initiative were members of the U.S. Navy Special Boat Team 20, who had actually been at Penn's Landing providing some public tours. Navy personnel assisted in pulling survivors from the water and with those who managed to swim to shore. So all in all, of the 37 total passengers and crew on board Duck Boat 34, 35 of them survived. The two fatalities were a 20-year-old male and a 16-year-old female from among the Hungarian student group. And they'd been seated next to one another.
Yeah. And they were the only two. I mean, if you look at the table in the report, you know, there was no major injuries except for that, the two fatalities. Everyone else kind of got out relatively like unscathed.
Yeah, with these, it's like you kind of just the nature of like the tragedy, you kind of sometimes lose sight of the fact that like it's pretty miraculous that only two people were killed in this.
Oh, yeah.
While at the same time, like obviously it's tragic that these two did lose their lives in what was an avoidable incident, as we'll get into here.
Yeah, just seeing like the still shot of the barge bow like impacting, if you had told me only two people, you know, don't make it out of this, like I wouldn't believe you.
Well, and also one thing, just kind of the nature of how the impact happened, you see an image of the duck boat post collision, and it looks surprisingly intact. You don't see like kind of the crush damage that certainly I expected to see. It looks like it's been through the ringer, but it doesn't look as demolished as you might expect it to.
Yeah, I think it slid kind of on the bottom of the barge a bit to, and I guess most, this is the stern probably took most of the impact, but yeah, go ahead.
Getting into kind of the breakdown of like what happened here, because it, you know, it seems like a pretty avoidable accident. So there's a couple main questions that come up here. Firstly, why did Duck 34 suffer that engine failure? Why was Caribbean Sea unresponsive to those multiple emergency calls? And what did contribute to those two fatalities among the passengers? So starting in the engine failure. So you think back to, you know, we said that wording was significant, that initial engine problem. The NTSB report described the master seeing, quote, what he took to be smoke coming from the engine compartment. And the post-accident examination of the engine compartment found no evidence of fire or smoke damage. However, what it did find was that the pressure cap of the engine's radiator surge tank was missing from its normal place and was instead loose in the bottom of the engine compartment.
They'll do that. That'll cause a problem.
I don't know anything about engines, so kind of reading that, I thought, I figured that was just like, oh, this is like a minor detail that someone forgot. And turns out, no, that's a big deal, actually. So, yeah, what this cap does is that it raises the boiling point of the engine coolant. So it allows the coolant to work at higher temperatures without turning to steam. So they tested this out on some other duck boats to see what does happen if this is left off. They concluded that the failure to have that cap installed properly led to the formation of steam that entered the passenger compartment and led to the master shutting down the engine because of what he, you know, assessed to be a fire. Mm. So basically this stuff is boiling off before it should with these temperatures.
Yeah. If you've ever had your radiator go or a coolant line go in your car, I had this happen to me. My old box, sorry for curse, Mazda 626. RIP to that car. it was bad, but I loved it. And I was driving and it just suddenly starts. I start getting like film on the front of the windshield, and then white smoke. But it smelled like this weird soap, burning soap kind of smell. And that it was the coolant. And luckily, in my case, it wasn't a radiator leak. It was just a coolant line leak, which is way easier to fix. But that's, and they described that there was like this burning rubber smell. Mm-hmm. But a car fire, usually it's not like white smoke or engine fire. It's usually not purely white smoke. Mm-hmm. And that's usually the sign of a coolant leak.
They weren't able to establish 100% why the engine coolant temperature had risen to 220 degrees. The boat had already completed two incident-free trips that day. So basically some combination of the air temperature, the boat speed, the water temperature, strain on the engine from the number of passengers, and working against the current as she was going northward.
I think a big thing too is, right, it's a 220 degrees, the coolant temperature, right? And it had been getting warm, and the deckhand didn't report this to the captain. Mm-hmm. When he thought there was a fire, he closed the fire dampers, mm-hmm. which raised the temperature of the engine. Uh-huh. And that just accelerated the coolant evaporation, right, and the smoke mm-hmm. production. Now, obviously, turning the engine off would slowly let the temperature come back down.
Right.
But had the captain check that first, kept the dampers open, there's no securing. Like, I know, like, you're supposed to, there's a fire on your boat, you secure the boat, right? You secure the engine, and prepare to, like, do firefighting procedure. Right, I understand that, but he diagnosed the problem incorrectly. And had he, the deckhand had said, "Hey, by the way, it was over 220 degrees," that would have been maybe I should have checked that first.
Right.
During that, like real quick, you're underway. You have many people on board you're responsible for. You're in the channel. How do I process this matrix in my head, this decision-making matrix? But you need to have everyone giving you all the information you need. And he didn't have that information. Mm-hmm. And the deckhand probably didn't really realize that.
It's a theme that we've seen on some of them is the not just knowing what to do, but kind of knowing how to gather the information you need. So like Tom, like you just said, of, you know, if that information is being shared, it's probably a much easier problem to diagnose. Mm-hmm. So with the mechanical issues explained to some extent, there's still the issue of communication. So even with this boat broken down, why wasn't this communication channel effective? Why doesn't the Caribbean Sea respond to any of these calls? So at the time of the collision, Caribbean Sea's mate was at the helm, and he'd taken control of the vessel around 11 a.m. that day. So the attached barge, the Resource, was empty on this leg of their trip. So before going off duty, the ship's captain had instructed the mate to steer the vessel from her upper wheelhouse rather than the lower wheelhouse. So with these tugs, at least some of them, they can be steered from either level. There's a lower wheelhouse and an upper. With the barge empty, and so it's riding higher in the water, steering from the upper wheelhouse was recommended because it gave you significantly better visibility for those on the vessel. Mm-hmm. The mate assures the master that that had been his plan already and that he'd steer from the upper wheelhouse. In a post-accident interview with the Coast Guard investigators, the mate also said that he had been in the upper wheelhouse when the collision occurred. However,
I was going to say, I see "however" all capitalized in the notes here.
Yeah.
Given the number of people at Penn's Landing, you know, there's lots of people within sight of this incident. This is the era where, you know, people have cameras on them.
It's high tourist season. It's right after 4th of July. There's lots of people there.
So some of the photographs being taken around this were of interest to investigators, since they appear to show the upper wheelhouse empty at the time of the collision.
I feel like everybody's lying. Like everyone involved is telling a different story than what happened.
Like our Empress of Ireland story of, you know, if everyone here is telling the truth, then this incident did not happen.
Right.
So something else further undermining the mate's original story are his actions immediately after the collision. So he runs to the master's quarters to let him know that there's been a collision. And the NTSB kind of has a very detailed, like verbal diagram of how this had to have happened. So basically to do this from the upper wheelhouse, he would have had to have been seen by the other two crew members who had also come out on deck. So the NTSB concluded that the only way the timing of his story worked out is that if he was coming from the lower wheelhouse. So that covers why the mate may not have seen the duck boat in the middle of the channel. But the other question is, why is there no response to these calls? I mean, he theoretically would have heard those in the lower wheelhouse as well. Mm-hmm. Even from that lower wheelhouse, it would have been possible to, you know, navigate the Caribbean Sea safely using radar, radio, and having a lookout posted. Evidence suggests the mate was not actively monitoring radar or radio.
The NTSB attempted to determine why. On the day of the accident, a trained, experienced, and otherwise competent mariner failed to effectively carry out routine but highly crucial tasks central to his profession. No evidence indicates that the mate was fatigued, and his post-accident toxicological tests show no signs of alcohol or illegal drugs.
So despite a company-wide prohibition on the use of personal cell phones on watch, phone records indicate the Caribbean Sea's mate spent a significant amount of his watch up until the collision, either placing or responding to phone calls. This amounted to between a third to a half of his total time he had been on watch. And the size of that gap is due to the fact that the phone records round all calls up to the next minute. So even if it's half a second into the next minute, it rounds it up. So there's a pretty wide range of time it could have been, but it was a significant portion of the time. The mate also made use of the company laptop to conduct internet searches throughout this time. That's a possible explanation for why he was in the lower wheelhouse, even though he'd said he would use the upper. The mate's actions are explained, though obviously not excused, by what he revealed after the incident. So quoting here from the NTSB report.
A KC transportation official told investigators that the mate had met with him briefly after the accident and told him about a serious medical emergency that affected the mate's child. The NTSB confirmed that such an emergency had occurred less than an hour before the mate reported for duty on the day of the accident.
So no one else in the company had been informed of this situation. No one knew about this until after the accident had happened. When that was revealed as a possible factor in the accident, KC actually provided the NTSB with evidence from the previous 18 months of 15 instances where employees had been granted emergency relief from duty to take care of family emergencies or other important matters. So again, like many other elements of this, it highlights some of the avoidability of that incident. In that, had this been raised with someone, the mate likely would have been able to attend to the issue rather than attempting to operate this vessel while distracted.
Although such a distraction is understandable, personal concerns cannot be allowed to create risks for others. If the mariner is unable to fully carry out his responsibilities for whatever reason, his duty is to turn over those responsibilities to someone else.
One of the things that we do before, like anytime we go like out on a patrol or something like that, we have like this, have you heard of I'm Safe? It's a acronym.
No.
And we have to go through all of it with each other. So we whip around doing like our pre-underway checklist. We whip around everybody. Does anyone have illness? Is anyone taking any medication we need to know about? Is there any stress? Is everything all right going on in your life? Is there anything, you know, tough? Like, did you drink anything within like the limit, like within the limit? So like you have to, I think it's like 12 hours before the patrol starts, you have to stop drinking. Are you tired? How'd you sleep? And what's your emotional state? And that, I know that started off with planes, Like that's their like their crew resource manager stuff, but we do it now too. And that's like a big, you can't, the guy was just that this is important that you do that. So I don't know, is part of it might be the fault of the crew member, but is there something, I don't want to preempt, but is something baked into the culture there where they're not talking about the stuff before they get underway?
Yeah.
That's something to think about.
Yeah. We deal with a lot of that too. I work in trucking. So, fortunately, the company I work for is really good about that kind of thing of not forcing guys out. Right. But, you know, it's a pretty well-known thing that if you've got an issue going on, let us know about that. We can accommodate that. Do you need a shorter night? Do you need to not run at all? Like, you know, and then we've sent people home regularly to be like, you don't need to be out there. I don't want to take the call from a state trooper that you plowed into a minivan full of kids. I don't want to do that. Right. So I would rather you stay home today and like get right before you come into work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the you know, if the culture of Casey had these built in, or had the guy just had the you know, hey man, listen, I don't know if I can. I mean, I get it too. I get like I don't want to let down my guys.
Absolutely.
Like, they're on this. This is like a regular thing they do. Like they're on this. So the resource barge was taking like solids from, there's a water treatment plant in Northeast Philly. So they're taking it downriver to I think it's like a place that filters out the solids. Mm-hmm. And it's like a twice a day thing or a regular thing that they were taking these barges back and forth. So, I mean, I guess maybe it's routine. I know the river real well. Like, you know, I mean, you literally could drive on the Delaware River without looking at a single buoy. Like, you know where you are, unless the weather's bad. It's pretty easy to navigate. But yeah, was there a culture there of doing that? Was he should have, I mean, obviously he should have said something, but you know.
So many of these things, it's like, it's very easy, you know, to diagnose that now. But yeah, I mean, I think it's also the issue of, you know, you have those and it could be nothing. So like, I don't want to, you know, make a big deal out of it if it's going to be fine. But, you know, here it's like, it's this guy's kid and you're having obviously like seems like a serious medical emergency. So
it was like something like the kid needed like the surgery or something like that. Like it was something really big. Like it wasn't like a minor thing. It was something where the kid's life might be. Yeah.
It's just like another like tragic element of this is, you know, the why it happened.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of Queen of the North at Canadian Ro-Ro Ferry, where I think it was like the third mate and the first mate had been in a relationship or something.
Yeah.
And they're like, the rumor is, and I don't know that it was ever fully like fleshed out, but like they're arguing on the bridge when the accident happens. And it's just always interesting to see these distraction things happen.
Distraction's a big thing. I mean, most boating incidents, it used to be before cell phones, it was BWI, and now it's distracted boating. It's the by far the most common cause of recreational. I know recreational boating incidents.
I can't imagine now with recreational boating. It's been a long time since I've been out on like a smaller boat, and it was definitely pre like smartphone era. And now I can only imagine that there's just so many people out there, you know, scrolling Twitter or, you know, making an Instagram post while they should be paying attention.
I mean, this summer, this very summer, this happened. We were coming back from a patrol headed up the river, and a guy was driving his boat with a beer can helmet and looked at us, saw us, and then threw it overboard. I mean, that, but, and that's 2010, right? Like, this isn't like that. Like, we had smartphones then.
It's one of those, like, there's, you know, different breeds of distraction. I mean, you know, this is an instance where were he not navigating a barge down a busy river, we'd say, well, yeah, of course he's going to be on his phone because this is a family emergency. But like, but yeah, it's like a distraction is a distraction, regardless of why.
Rule 5 of the navigation rules says that, you know, all vessels shall keep a proper lookout by sight, sound, and other means at all times. Like, all times. There's no exceptions to that.
Right. We've looked at the mechanical aspects. We've looked at the communication aspect. Looking at the crew performance on Duck 34 and ultimately the two casualties that do occur. So the NTSB judged the Duck Boat Master's performance to be appropriate up until the point that the boat was at anchor. At this point, though, best practice and Ride the Duck's emergency procedures would have called for him to issue life jacket orders at the point of either an onboard fire or loss of propulsion.
Yep.
Reading through the reports, kind of the quick narrative version of it, that was one of the first things reading it. You know, I've read at this point enough of these to see like what does the captain normally do at what time? And here it was a bit it jumped out that, you know, as soon as this thing is, it loses power and it's at anchor, that this order was not given to, hey, at least put on your life jackets.
It's like you have a steering casualty, you know, or injury casualty. We would already have our PPE on, but life jackets on. But like, if you're going to tow another boat, that's got like, as soon as you come over, hey, you guys lost your injury. All right, get your life jackets on right now. Like, we can't even touch your boat until you do that. Like, it's just basic, because your boat can't move. And if something like this happens, we want to have this done now in case you do need to jump off your boat, not wait till the last minute and give those orders, and give those orders in an emergency while there's panic happening with people who may have never seen a life jacket before.
Yeah. That's something I was going to say, that it's one thing when you're dealing with like, a merchant marine crew or someone that's used to putting on a life jacket, whereas you're dealing with like 16, 17 year old kids that have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, they're in hungry. I mean, I know they have lakes and rivers in Hungary, but, you know, it's not a maritime nation, you know.
That order to don life jackets wasn't given until about 30 seconds before the collision. So like we said, that gives you a situation where there's not a single passenger who gets their life jacket on before they're in the water. So another criticism of the Master's actions post-anchoring was his failure to alert the Coast Guard. We talked about this is one of the first things we talked about with this story, after the loss of propulsion in a navigation channel that allows the Coast Guard to alert other vessels and get people on scene earlier.
Yeah, you want to put out a like a securite, hey, there's a hazard in navigation. You know, the Coast Guard could have done that, or a pompon, you know, hey, look, we're not sinking, but we need help.
Right.
But, you know, I think part of that, too, is they had their own procedure and he thought help was on the way. So he's thinking, I'm just securing until it is. But anchoring in the channel, I, at that point, it's like, once you make that decision, that is I'm going to go on 16. And even if you just went on 16 and announced it yourself, like the Coast Guard would have repeated it and they would have contacted for more information.
One last thing here. The Master did not direct the deckhand to undertake any safety-related actions during the 8 minutes between dropping anchor and the collision. Things like acting as a lookout and or assisting passengers with life jackets.
And one thing from the report that's not in here that I know that was that the deckhand and the captain did not have an understanding of who had watch. So they thought they shared the duties, which you can share the duties, but in a situation where, hey, I'm going under, I got to, you know, check the engine. Just take a look around, right? Keep your eye out. Let me know if anything changes. That's something that wasn't made clear, you know, and it should have been something like, you know, this is obviously in hindsight, but, you know, hey, I'm going under, you take a look out, or, hey, before I go under, let's get all these guys' life jackets on. Then I go, like, that would have been the appropriate, like chain of action. But he thinks the boat's on fire. That makes you panic.
Yeah.
So talking about like the, not really a clear understanding of who had what responsibility in the report. I think it uses the word assume from both of them, saying deckhand assumed that the captain was monitoring, you know, one direction. The captain assumed that the deckhand was keeping watch on like a full 360 degree basis. So yeah, we see that all the time of if that communication doesn't happen. I mean, if the captain has him do that, I mean, I guess the worst case scenario is the deckhand says, yeah, I'm already doing it. But yeah, it's like having that communication and just making sure that you know what's what here.
The skipper's responsibility in that case, yeah, is to be like, all right, but cuz, right, we're Phillies, we're calling cuz, right, but, you know, you got to watch everyone. And then he's like supposed to respond. Like, I know it sounds dorky, but like, you're like, you know, hey, Joe, you got bow watch eye. Like, you respond. Like, there's a reason there's a call and response in one boats. That's how it's supposed to go. I know. And people are like, oh, well, you're acting like gung ho or hard charger or whatever like that. You're way too motivated. Like, no, that's how it works on a boat. Like, you need to know that I know that you acknowledge that, you know?
So the NTSB concluded that the deckhand had been distracted from his lookout duties. When the collision occurred, the duck boat was relatively fortunately pushed underwater to the port side of the barge rather than being crushed directly under it. So like we said, just the way that this collision happens, you hate to say it, but like, it could have been so much worse than it was. That combined with the presence of vessels in the area, that quick emergency response, that's why we have 35 people who do survive this incident. So regarding the two who didn't survive, you know, there's an element of chance sometimes to these things that kind of defies explanation. At the same time, you know, they did want to look at what was the safety briefing like You know, was it adequate? Did it cover all the stuff that they needed to know? Because they did conduct a safety briefing before going out on the water. 11 of the 13 surviving Hungarian passengers commented critically about the safety briefing, although none of the native English speakers did.
Yeah, and having read that, he's very jokey and funny during it. Mm-hmm. Right? He's keeping it light. But, you know, and I get why. I understand that, you know. And when you're a tour guide, you're trying to get laughs the entire time. And it's just part of it. You want it to be fun. But, you know, that new level of nuance is lost on someone who's that L1's not English. You know, that's like the last thing that comes in language is usually the idioms and all that stuff. And let's make this. Hey, we're going to stop joking aside. You know, hey, we're going to do something dangerous. In all events, this is probably not going to happen, but I need you to all pay attention to me for the next minute or two, right? And then I'm going to tell you what to do. And that, I don't want to get ahead of it, but yeah, that didn't happen.
Yeah, and like you can read in the report, you can kind of read his full, you know, this is the thing that he runs through. And you notice even like the very last line of it ends with like a joke. Yeah. It might seem lame or whatever, but it's like this is actually the serious business. Dealing with people who, you know, you're giving these tours, you're probably going to be dealing with people who don't have English as their first language. That nuance is lost. I incorporate a lot more humor with my upper level students because I'm confident that they're going to get what I'm saying. Whereas, you know, with a lower level student or someone who doesn't have as good listening proficiency, yeah, you want to be a little bit more direct and a little bit less, I think, jovial is how he described the way he delivered those. There's such a sharp divide between who thought it was fine and who thought it wasn't enough. So one element of the criticism came from the fact that the master didn't physically demonstrate by putting on the jacket and fastening it. I was thinking of you every time you get on a plane, you watch those, you watch them go through. They show you how to fasten the seatbelt. They show you how to, you know, put on the mask, whatnot. And they physically demonstrate that to you as they're explaining it.
In this case, the safety briefing the master gave was ineffective in that it did not convey the importance of the information and did not fully explain what passengers may need to do in the event of an emergency. The deficiency was exacerbated by the fact that the information was not presented in a way that made it fully comprehensible to passengers with limited fluency in English.
Yeah, so one of the things that we'll kind of look in the aftermath portion here in just a minute on what they kind of do with that information. So about a week after the incident, the Coast Guard required Ride the Ducks to stop passenger operations in the Delaware River. In August 2010, Ride the Ducks submitted an operational plan to resume operations with some increased safety provisions. So this included a pre-stage rescue craft that they could deploy anytime boats are in the water. No more than 3 duck boats out on the river at any given time. A revised maximum distance from shore. So this would keep the boats out of the navigation channel. So you can't break down in the navigation channel.
Yeah, the only time they would transit would be when they're coming out of the dock, and then they would go. They would be in the middle of if you're in the middle of the river, you're actually out of the channel at that part. Yeah.
A maximum water time of 15 minutes. Again, like the less time these things spend on the water, the better in general. And no water operations when tugboat barge combinations are within a half mile of the tour route.
If you've got to put a limit on how long the boat can be in the water, then like, I don't want to be on that boat.
Yeah, boats are supposed to be in the water a long time. They're supposed to be good at that. That's why they're boats.
So these duck boat passenger operations resumed in April of 2011.
To the consternation and hatred of everyone in the city who was very happy with them being on pause.
So other changes made to the duck boat operations included rewiring the air horn so it would function regardless of the engine status. A standardized and re-scripted safety briefing. So this one would include a full demonstration of donning a life jacket and a revision of the training program to highlight bridge resource management and situational awareness. So not just Ride the Ducks, but KC Transportation also made changes to their policies. The tugboats that didn't have one, all the tugboats were required to have an upper wheelhouse. So navigation from the upper wheelhouse was required rather than just recommended when towing an empty barge. Lookouts required to be posted on barges at all times, and quoting here, at no time during the operation of the tugboat with barge in tow may the helmsman or designated lookout use the cell phone for personal reasons. The off watch is to be alerted if watch stander is distracted for any reason. And I think that last point was more of a kind of a restatement or maybe just a highlighting of an already existing policy. Just trying to make sure that this is crystal clear that you cannot do this if you are in command of the vessel. In terms of I was very quickly able to look at some of the aftermath of this. I believe the mate ultimately received a 1-year prison sentence.
Yes.
There was a $17 million settlement reached. I don't really know the details of who that went to and how that was divided up.
It went to the victims.
And aside from that, and I think we already made reference to this, but ultimately those Philly duck boats would cease operation in 2016.
Yeah. After, like I said, claiming the life of a grandmother because their machines are hunger for blood. but there's a couple things here, like obviously like hindsight and like, and this is like the same with like any, you know, like the NTSB is like really good is they give these third reports and you can use them to like improve your own processes and they give the recommendations, which is always good. You know, one of the things that I didn't see in this report was just something that we were talking about is there's no lookout on the barge. And typically with a vessel, I mean, a vessel that's that big, and this was the whole debate, like, what do you need a lookout on the barge? Like, now, if it was like a, I believe it was a combined unit where like it's it fit in, those kinds do exist, that it, you might have needed to have a lookout at the bow. But like regardless, like that would have been best practice is to have a lookout at the bow that had like a radio and could radio back. Sorry, my cat's no, he's talking to me. but he's jealous I'm talking to someone else and not him. That's the issue there too. And I had heard through like, you know, through the grapevine for some people who were involved that the fault was kind of like 70-30. Mm-hmm. Like this wasn't like a, it was set ended up being settled, but like how it was shaken out was like 70% tug, 30% duck boat. I don't know if that was like an insurance thing or ended up being anything in the case, but that's what some people who were like involved in the case afterwards had you know passed down to me. But it's you can't view on your phone. So like on patrols and stuff, like you literally cannot be on a phone. If you have to be on the phone, you have to like all right, give someone else the helm. And now that, and you know, for us now, because we've had incidents, like you have to have the coxswain can't leave the helm area. Mm-hmm. So it used to be like the coxswain could leave to like, you know, duck in the back to fix the machinery or something like that. And you would leave your crew up there. Can you, I mean, there's like exceptions in case of emergency, but like for the most part, you can't have your supervisor leave. So he's up there unattended, like, which to me, if the Coast Guard requires a boat that's bigger than 21 feet to have like two crew, so you have someone could drive and someone could look, you know, or someone can handle it. Like that's the bare minimum. Is that really what we want? Is one guy, okay, he's in the upper wheelhouse. Great. But what if it was on the starboard side of the, you know, opposite,
right?
You know, still not gonna be able to see everything.
Right.
So and that was the big thing that like we were talking about is, if you don't have a lookout on the bow, if you don't have a second, at least a second hand, like that's still not really the optimal thing. And of course, that comes down to like, no, I got to get another guy and I got to pay him.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah. This one was, you know, kind of went into this expecting kind of some of the same duck boat issues, although this one kind of brought up some different ones. You know, we had kind of talked about how this one isn't even necessarily contingent on it being a duck boat. Right. You know, theoretically this could have happened with any kind of small craft, but yeah, I mean, there's issues and there's complications with running these things. And it's
the only thing that I could think would have made a difference if it was a dedicated boat, it would have had a pump pulling water out of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so the coolant wouldn't have had that issue. Not to say that a cap couldn't have loosened anyway, you know, where you couldn't have had an engine overheat. But yeah, they wouldn't have the coolant leak in the same way. Because there's, I mean, not that there are boats that have coolant separate, but you know, a lot of boats just pulled. It's because you have free coolant right there. Just right. Pull through the through the
yeah, entry. And that's the kind of the crazy thing about so many of these stories is that it does come down to, you know, possibly something as small as, you know, someone not screwing on a lid. Mm-hmm. Or screwing on a cap properly, or maybe even forgetting it entirely. But yeah, that tiny little, you know, piece of plastic or whatever ends up causing a major problem. Yeah, so I think that is going to wrap up our story for today. This was as much fun, I think, as I could have had talking about a story like this.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough with this kind of stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you listen to the episodes I did on Whether It's Your Problem, you know, when it came time to be human about it, you know, mm-hmm. it's time to be human about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, loss of life is a shame. And the city was really, I mean, it was right after 4th of July. And I was telling you guys before mm-hmm. we were on the air, like I was in the area 2 days before that happened. Like I was on the, we're doing the fireworks. That's where the fireworks barge would park, is right off there. Right. So it's I think it goes to show that, like, and your podcast is like an example. It's like, you don't mess with water. It doesn't play.
Right.
the ocean, the lake. Because I almost drowned in the lake. All right. Lakes mm-hmm. don't play either. That was right. the dumbest thing ever that I almost drowned doing. And I think about it and cringe sometimes. but you know, I was swimming after a noodle that left and the wind was pushing it faster than I could swim. And then this is post COVID and I didn't have my cardio capacity that I used to be able to swim really well. And I'm like, oh, I can't swim anymore. And there's no bottom for me to touch. And I was like, all right, okay, I just got to tread water. But the like waves in the lake, because the wind was pushing enough, was enough for me to like, it was tough to tread water a little bit. Then someone, and no one, I was the only one in that boat that was sober. And I was the only one who knew how to drive a boat, pick a person out of the water. So that was really dumb of me. I should have sent someone else to do it, because I could have got them on top. I know how to pull someone out of the water. But it's like, all I could think about is me die, my funeral, and all my friends who do volunteer with me making fun of me for trying to save a pool noodle. That's how I drown.
You would be the safety third segment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's hard finding that balance in these of, you know, I don't want to sit here and read like an NTSB report and be sad about each one of these. But like, yeah, it's finding that balance of humor and still education, I guess, with this stuff.
And I do. I honestly, you know, I feel for the duck boat people. I do think the duck boat captain definitely should have made some better choices. But the guy who ran them over, I mean, he's already having a bad day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, man, now. You got a kid who's sick. It's like, oh man, you just made it worse. You should have just said something. So like, talk to your boys when you're not feel, when you're blue, like don't hold it in. Like people care. Go talk to, you know, I'm not saying go find a therapist or anything. Tell you work with these guys every day. Tell them, hey man, like my kid's sick, man. Mm-hmm. Just tell people, mm-hmm. you know, communicate
absolutely.
Your mental health, not just on boats. On boats is more important, and in airplanes and anything where you could kill somebody with. But also just, you know,
just in general,
talk to your friends. If you're feeling sad and something bad's happening, don't hold it in.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it just remains for us to thank Tom for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And for listening to and supporting the show.
Did you want to shout out your podcast while you're here too, for anyone that may not be aware?
Yeah. So, me and my friend Liam of, well, there's your problem fame. We have a Philadelphia sports ish podcast called 10,000 Losses. It's not 10,000 posts. they originally had blocked us at first when they found out. I had talked to Devin and we smooth things over. But yeah, you can listen to that. It is Philly sports centric, but we do go into like the latest episode isn't up yet, 'cause I've been busy, but, the next one is basically going to be Liam, myself, and my friend, who's a guest, talking about the various times that we have sped and broke the law. It's supposed to be about sports, but we're talking about how fast we've gone over bridges. So it's kind of just, you know, guys talking dumb stuff, but also sports.
Nice.
From a leftist perspective, a pro-labor perspective, without being chuds.
I just yesterday I was listening to your episode you did with the guys from Tipping Pitches.
Yes.
I really enjoy 10,000 Losses.
Thank you.
Having no connection whatsoever to Philly or Philly sports, it's still an enjoyable listen because of the lovely hosts that the show has. So
appreciate it.
Awesome.
All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up. So we are going to end things here, and we will be back next week with something for you. So we'll talk to you all then.
Bye.